Are you Invictus? Clint, are you Invictus? Are you Invictus?
What does it mean?
You know, when I started the Invictus Mind podcast, my goal was to unite a bunch of people who had a similar ideology or a similar characteristic traits. Invictus means unconquerable. It's an old Greek word for means unconquerable.
Unconquerable.
So, honestly, it was a new concept to me. I had to Google it when you sent it to me. But yeah, I do my best.
Tell me about what the show, what is your audience looking for? Tell me.
This is your first time here. This is the number one program dedicated to helping individuals maximize their potential and truly become unconquerable. Here we have discussions about what it takes and what it means to experience and magnify political freedom, financial freedom, and spiritual freedom.
Yes, I would absolutely say that. I'm going to keep getting up, right? And I keep getting up and I keep pushing forward. And that's the type of mindset that you need to have.
I never lose hope. I never lose faith. My mindset has always been, if I want something, I don't give up.
So let me tell you what is the number one issue when it comes to being unconquerable.
Okay.
And the number one word you have to think about here is not intelligence, not savvy, not strength, none of those things. The number one thing is resilience.
You know I'm Invictus. Come on. All right. I'm Invictus AF.
Well, may I have an initiation question for my tribe?
Okay.
Are you Invictus?
I believe I am.
So yes, I agree. I am Invictus.
I totally agree, man. And I think that if there's anybody on this planet that's unconquerable, it's probably me. I am not the type to take orders, and I am definitely in a position that I can stand up for myself right now. So,
and I was like, no way, I know what that word means now.
yeah, man, very cool concept for a show.
You didn't ask me if I was Invictus.
So I'm just going to get started, Jason. I don't feel I need to introduce you to the audience. You are my brother. We share last names, and there's only so many Corbells in the world.
That is true.
And I was just looking back at the last time you were on the podcast. Do you remember the dates?
No, I do not remember. I have to say it's, what, almost 2 years ago now, or is it?
Close to it. It was December 13th of 2020.
There you go. So, yeah, it's been a while.
Do you remember what we called the episode?
Nope. Sorry.
No, it's all right. Don't eminentize the Eschaton is what
I named it. Oh, that's right. Yes, I remember we talked about that. Yes, we were talking about that. That was a quote from William F. Buckley.
Right, right. And so here we are living in the apocalypse in 2022, and people are still trying to eminentize the Eschaton.
That is true. That is true.
As I say to most people, life just continues. So like the worst years of your life probably has happened or hasn't happened yet, but either way, you got to continue. But really, I wanted to invite you on my podcast, Jason, because sometimes I need to be grounded in reality. I know that I live inside this internet world as a podcaster and an influencer of sorts. I say sorts because I'm not very popular, but of sorts on Twitter. And okay. I see you on Facebook from time to time, but since you and I are flesh and blood, sometimes it's just nice to talk to somebody who you've met and you know personally.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. But I've seen a few of your episodes. They're pretty good.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm just doing it for my legacy. And, sometimes some people like some of the ideas I throw out there. But I wanted
you've had a few pretty big names on there, so.
Yeah,
I imagine you're getting some following from them as well. So
it's not always about the numbers. I just had a conversation with a guy by the name of Jason from the 2Bit podcast, and we were talking about numbers and things of that nature. It actually was a really good episode, and it kind of ties into what we're talking about, what I want to talk about today.
Okay.
So some strange reason, and I can't put my arm around it. I know we talked offline about the same thing, but for some strange reason, since like 2020, when COVID hit, a lot of the influencers that I've kind of been in circles with have shifted away from libertarianism and more towards Christianity, but Orthodox Christianity. Have you noticed that trend at all?
I noticed a few people that I've seen. I mean, there's been more people talking about it. There's been a few people I've seen who shifted that way. A friend of mine, he's not in the podcast world, but he kind of went more Catholic, but yeah, heading more toward traditional, you know, traditional Christianity and such. I definitely have noticed that. And I think that there's a good reason for it. And, you know, I guess that's what we're going to get into. So,
well, so on the one hand, we saw some of the most tyrannical government in our lifetime under the COVID regime, and still continuing on under the what I'm calling the anti-humanist team, because it's all the same thing. It's whatever causes people to be fearful and not happy in families. And
actually an interesting word, though, that you choose, anti-humanist, because I would say that in many ways, the woke crowd, who is the perceived cultural enemy of these folks, are decidedly humanist, secular humanists.
Sure. I mean, you can categorize them as humanist as an ideology, but they're anti-human. So I guess, which is where I'm kind of getting that terminology. Okay. They're anti-life. They're anti anything that's good and wholesome. And so what people are noticing is that this is such a powerful force in the world that they're turning towards things of higher meaning, because we're seeing the world just draped with nihilism, right? People are looking for meaning in their life. And we can date this back to Jordan Peterson, and I don't want to bring too much of him up right now, but I feel that there's so much I could talk to you that we might need a couple episodes for this anyway to hash it all out.
I was just laughing because do you remember that movie, The Big Lebowski?
Yeah. The dude.
Do you remember when the bad guys are nihilists and John Candy's character, he's all like, you know, say what you will about the tenets of National Socialism, but at least that was an ethos. These people, they don't believe in anything.
Yeah, well, that's exactly true. And so, you know, at the same time, I might think that the world has been, or maybe not the world, because I can only come from the United States perspective, really.
What was that guy's name? I'm sorry.
Turtletub. John Turtletub.
No. That's not his name. He played the husband on Roseanne as well. What was that guy's name?
You just had to interrupt my thought.
I'm sorry. I was just thinking about that movie. I'm sorry. You got me thinking about that movie. It's a good movie. I'm sorry. Go on.
Okay, so speaking of nihilists, so what the heck was I talking about? What I was trying to talk about is that, you know, so at a point in the United States over the last 2 years, especially, I don't think that this country has seen so much just radical atheism that I've seen in my lifetime.
Okay. Yeah.
At the same time, the people who don't want to fall into that category, you call it wokeism, radical atheism, whatever we want to call it, the ones who are against that are finding more towards Christianity, which I'm really happy about.
Well, I mean, you know, you want to talk about immanentizing the eschaton, you know, you can get into different various interpretations, theological systems of what the last days will look like. Obviously, different denominations have different viewpoints on that. And there's many different types of Christians who have different viewpoints on that. But, you know, coming from my background, I can say, you know, it's not surprising. It talks about how, you know, there's going to be a division. There's going to be a gathering. You're going to have, you know, the followers of Christ on one side, and you're going to have the other, you know, the other people on the other side. And then for a little while, it's going to look like the other people are winning. Obviously, we know who comes out on top in the end, according to the story that we follow. But I think that you can kind of see that clearly playing out. And because you're exactly right, there's a surge of this. Well, I mean, I don't know if it's a surge so much as it's just we live in a post-Christian age. Mm. And I think that some people are drifting toward orthodox and more traditional beliefs because they've seen it kind of coming for a long time. And in addition, you know, you're going to get into the political, geopolitical, you know, stuff that's going on to understand where that even comes from. Because, you know, let's look at geography for a minute. You know, the West, Europe, you know, what was traditionally Western Christendom, you know, that's they're really post-Christian. Okay. But the Eastern Bloc, they already had kind of a post-Christian time where, you know, you had the Soviet Union, the rise of atheism, atheistic communism that, you know, took much of Eastern Europe under its sway. And they kind of had that for a little while and tasted what that was like. And then when that collapsed, and it collapsed, you know, and so many people suffered from that, I think that, you know, they went back to their traditional roots, which had always been the church. And you know, what's interesting is that the communists, the communists that took over the Soviets, they would be considered radical right by a lot of today's leftists, a lot of the woke crowd, if you will, for their you know, their social views, their views on things like race, sexuality, and stuff like that, national identity. They would have been considered far right by some of these wokists, I think, and these are communists we're talking about. So I think that, you know, the East never went through that wokism, even though they suffered from Soviet communism and from that whole time. They've always been that traditional, you know, social values. And I think that they were the first ones calling out what was happening in the West. You know, they've been Rod Dreher, who is, I don't know if you know who he is. He's a writer. He writes for the American Conservative. Mm. I've seen a lot from the American Conservative. Sometimes I've seen some of his stuff posted on Intellectual Takeout. Don't know if you follow that one.
I've seen it.
And he's been talking about, he wrote a book a while back called The Benedict Option. Mm. I haven't read it, so I can't say exactly, you know, anything what it says. But from my understanding, based on the articles he's written, basically he's talking about Benedict, you know, the monk from way back, you know, the monasticism, when he kind of like around the time of the collapse of the Roman Empire and everything was in turmoil. You had a lot of Christians who would leave and, you know, go basically live out in the middle of nowhere in like little monasteries and stuff. And Benedict was one of these guys. And I think from what I understand, the Benedict option is kind of like, it's encouraging Christians to group together, be more communal, but be prepared for living in a post-Christian society because the majority is going that way. I think that because the East never really experienced that, you know, they had a resurgence in religiosity after the Soviet state collapsed and people were looking for order and meaning. The church was there, the Orthodox Church was there. So they've already kind of had that cycle where they had the secular atheism and then there was the collapse. And now they were warning the West. And I think because they've had that loud voice warning the West about what's coming, that's probably why a lot of people are gravitating toward that right now.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's a lot to that. And it's just some of the vernacular that I've heard. I mean, it's not something that's unique, but it just seems to be trending more. Things like demonic, right? People are demons. People are, you know, possessed by spirits. And I'm not saying that Christianity as a whole doesn't believe in that kind of stuff. But from my perspective, just growing up, you know, obviously – you and I were, well, I'll tell our story briefly. We grew up Lutheran and then we became Mormons, right?
Yeah.
And so Mormonism to me is very mystical, very spiritual, whereas many of the other faiths are not so, except for what I see from Orthodoxy. And so I'm hearing a lot of this this mystical realm resurfacing in the new age, in the apocalypse right now.
See, I don't know. I don't know that they're not mystical. Okay. Well, I mean, they kind of aren't. I'm thinking about the American evangelical, your typical American evangelical. I think that, I think that they're probably as ideologically possessed as the people on the left, only to the other side. You know, you see a lot of them, you know, these are your MAGA people, your Trump people, a lot of them. I don't know that they don't believe in the mystical so much as I think it's hard for me to understand evangelical Protestants. So because you didn't bring them up, I'll go there. But yeah, I mean, I don't think that it's that they reject the mystical so much as they have a very limiting view of God. When I look at Protestantism as a whole, I take it, I kind of dismiss it. I mean, I was raised Lutheran, so I know a little bit about Protestantism. I would say Lutheranism is probably the least silly of the Protestant. And I can say that because I went through a phase in that you never went through. And that was, you know, after our parents got divorced and I moved away with mom, we became Baptist for a while. Attended a Southern Baptist church. And so I've experienced Lutheranism. I've experienced being a Baptist. And then after that, I kind of went through a brief bout of atheism before I found Mormonism. But I would call it more of an agnosticism. I even thought I was a Buddhist there for a while. I think that it's not that they don't believe in the mystical. I think that they think that God is tied into politics too much, whereas the Orthodox kind of are looking for like the more, you know, behind the scenes thing. You know, they're more in touch with the, you know, the church as this mystical institution of the heavens. And I really think it's because I would call it, I'm trying to think of the technical term for it. I think it's ecclesiology, the study of churches, and you have what's called high and low ecclesiology. And basically it's the view of the church. Okay. Mm-hmm. So like Mormons, we have a very high ecclesiology, meaning that we have a very high view of the church. We take ideas such as church authority very, very seriously. You know, the priesthood authority, that's basically our claim to our religion is that we are the true church of Jesus Christ restored, because we have that authority through a prophet, you know, through Jesus Christ, who appeared to a prophet and called a new prophet to do this. The Orthodox claim is that, you know, they still have an unbroken line of succession from the apostles, and that there was never any apostasy, very similar to the right. Catholic. So the Orthodox and the Catholic are very similar in that way. I mean, there's obviously many differences between Orthodox and Catholic, mostly because I think Catholics have adopted more of the psychological view of God, kind of like what you hear Jordan Peterson talking about in his biblical lectures. I enjoyed his biblical lectures, but I think they took a very Catholic view of things. I think that's very much what you hear in a Catholic faith. Okay, that the kind of like, you know, very philosophical view of God, not as a personal being, but as more of a force in the universe, if you will.
Well, that's interesting because, so Jordan Peterson, we can talk about more length, but he was last seen posting something on Twitter with Jonathan Peugeot, which I think they went to an Orthodox liturgy.
Right. Yeah, I think so too. And they do have a lot in common, believe it or not. I mean, neither one of them would probably be uncomfortable in one of the other ones. The falling out had to do with the veneration of icons and such like that, when that was, you know, almost 1,000 years ago. So other than that, it's basically been, you know, they're pretty similar, only the Orthodox don't, obviously they don't accept the authority of the Pope. And, you know, they don't accept anything like that. But and I think there's, you know, there's some differences in theology. I don't have a comparative book in front of me about Catholic and Orthodox, but let's just say they're more similar than either one of them or us are to Protestants. Okay. Because right. Protestants have a very low ecclesiology. They don't believe, like, for instance, many Protestants, especially on the evangelical side, they don't believe in the need for priesthood. You know, you'll hear the idea of, you know, the whole idea that priesthood is a stupid idea, or the priesthood of all believers, you know, like basically everybody has authority because we believe. You know, you ask an evangelical, well, where'd you get your authority to go become a preacher? Well, I get it from the Bible, you know, so they believe in taking authority just because you read a book. Oh, right. I read a book and I interpret it a certain way that gives me authority. So they have what's called a very low ecclesiology, whereas Orthodox, Catholics, and Mormons, we all have a high ecclesiology. Okay, so one thing that you'll notice about the reason that reminds me why I was bringing up the
ecclesiastical.
Yeah, it's ecclesiastical, but it's ecclesiology. It's the study or the view of the church, if you will.
Okay.
And the Mormons and the Orthodox and the Catholics have very high ecclesiology, whereas, you know, your evangelical Protestants have a very low ecclesiology. What's important with that is that they look at the ordinances. Like take Calvinists, for instance, Reformed. They don't even believe in the necessity of baptism. Okay, like that's not even important. Like it's just like the outward sign of your faith. It's not important. It doesn't actually do anything. In apologetic circles, we talk about, you know, we call that baptismal regeneration. The idea that when you're baptized, that your sins are actually wiped away. Like that you actually are, you know, the ordinance itself has power. Catholics believe very much that ordinances themselves have power. You know, they take the issue, for instance, the Eucharist, what we would call the sacrament. Sure. They believe in that being transubstantiation. You know, it turns literally, mystically into the body and the blood of Christ as they consume it. The Orthodox, I don't think they actually have a transubstantiation doctrine, but they also have a very high view of that, of the sacrament, that it's a very important thing, that it actually does something for you. Latter-day Saints, we believe the same thing. You know, we talk in the church, a lot of leadership in the church talks about, well, renewing our covenants. But if you really dive into the theology behind that, that's just kind of a popular thing to say, because what our theology actually teaches is that when we take the sacrament, that at that moment, we're as clean as if we had just come out of the waters of baptism again.
Hmm.
So the ordinance itself has power. And if you look at it, that's a mystical view. You know, the ordinance of baptism actually has power. The ordinance of the Eucharist or the sacrament actually has power. Priesthood healing. We believe in priesthood healings. We believe in, you know, these mystical things. I think that when you look at the Protestants, they don't really have that mystical view of things because of the fact that they have a low ecclesiology. They don't really think that the ordinances are all that important. You know, their faith in, you know, salvation by faith alone. So the ordinances don't really matter that much. So I think, though, that if you strip something of its power and make it merely a symbol to say these things don't actually mean anything, they don't actually have any power, that people will gravitate away from that in a time of confusion, because, you know, anything can be symbolic of anything. If it doesn't have anything real going on, what's the point? And, you know, people are looking at the world and they're seeing that there's just something wrong. You can tell it when you talk to these woke people. I don't want to say demonic, although it may be in some of their cases, but it's certainly an ideological possession, and you can feel it. You can feel this like spiritual energy almost. It's like a very negative spiritual energy that comes from a lot of these people. And I think that people are gravitating toward faiths that are going to have, you know, hey, we have power in these ordinances.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. So one thing that I haven't toyed with, but I've entertained some of the people I've been listening to's thought process is that, what we're seeing right now in 2022 America and really worldwide is the culmination of the Enlightenment in history.
Okay, so now you're getting into the Orthodox beliefs that, like, say, I hear a lot of like more Eastern Orthodox people who suggest that the Enlightenment was a negative thing.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't.
Well, before you go on, I want to just add this thought to what we're going to talk about here, because I had this conversation with somebody via Twitter. I don't remember the whole details about it, but I look at Mormonism as being obviously the true church, but I also look at it taking the best of Western values, but keeping some of that, I don't know what word you said, ecclesiology of the right. Eastern religion. So there's kind of the Eastern worldview and a Western worldview mixed up, in which makes it complete and whole.
Well, I can get behind that. I'm a little leery of saying that because of the fact that I don't want to give people the impression that Mormonism is something that was come up with by a man.
Right. You know, so it's not like libertarianism. We're a little conservative and a little.
Right. It's not like Joseph Smith was sitting there and saying, well, we're going to take this from here. We're going to take this from here. That's what the critics of our church say. And, you know, we see a little bit of that, you know, in some of the symbols chosen, and that's fine. You know, but that's not the ordinance itself has power. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, you know, some of the ways that we do our, you know, some of the cultural things that we do, we took from other places and stuff like that. But the religion itself, you know, our claim is that it came from heaven. And, mm-hmm. and I believe that claim. So I'm not going to say what we, you know, I think that what you can see is, you know, you can see this is kind of the standard answer that missionaries will give. But it's the answer I'll give here, too. And that is that, you know, if you look at our claim, which is that we're the restored church. And then you say, well, it looks like we got a little bit of here and a little bit of here. Well, you know, if the claim is true, then you kind of think of like the church as like a mirror. Okay. Mm. And like the apostasy, that mirror got broken and you had like, you know, so each individual little piece is still glass. So you're going to see, you know, parts of that mirror in that glass. And then the restored church came together and that, you know, restored the mirror. And so obviously there's going to be, you know, it's just like the mirror was before, or maybe I should say a painting, you know, maybe not a mirror, maybe a painting, like a painting that got ripped up. Okay. Mm-hmm. And when the whole painting is restored, you can see where little pieces exist in these other little places that came from that broken or that, you know, that torn up painting. So obviously you're going to see a little bit from each in the restored whole painting, if that makes sense.
Well, absolutely. And one of our tenets of the faith is that we welcome all truth.
Right.
And so what was the name of that? I just saw this on an episode of the Midnight Mormons. They were talking about a religion that was just in pursuit of truth. It wasn't about Christianity or Christ. It was that we claim all truth is only religion. And I was thinking, that's kind of like Mormonism, except, you know, Jesus Christ is what we'll call the truth, right? The way, the truth, and all that stuff. But we don't have a little of everything. We have all the right pieces put together. And so, but you can still find truth in many places. I mean, you can find truth within a secular world. You can find truth within other religions. And so what's ironic is that most of the religions you talk to will argue that, you know, we are, you know, we're not, we're the fake Christians right there. We believe in a different God and like that. And our claim is exactly the opposite of it.
Well, if I'm talking to Calvinists, I actually agree with them. I believe in a different God from theirs. I think their God is a monster. I'm serious. I say that with all truth. I mean, to my Calvinist friends, if any of you are hearing, I love you, but your God is terrible. He's a moral monster.
Okay, so I mean, there is the argument about the word Christian, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we believe that we are followers of Jesus Christ,
right?
But then I've also learned that the word Christian was a pejorative that was used against people that called themselves the follower of the way. And that word was used first in Antioch. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, are we Christians or are we followers of the way? Because, you know, from what I see culturally, Mormonism wants to try to fit in line with more other traditional Christians. But I think that we should embrace our differences because, you know, not just because we're unique, but because we have the full truth.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more on that. I mean, I honestly couldn't agree with you more. I think that culturally speaking, Mormonism has a problem. And that is that when you look at it in the early days of Mormonism, they came from kind of the radical element. Okay, a lot of them were seekers and they didn't have formal churches, or if they did, you know, they came from a lot of different backgrounds, but it was mostly Protestant. Culturally, it was mostly Puritan because it came from New York. Okay. And as they kind of gathered people from all over, people came from Europe, people came from all over the United States, kind of gathered together. You know, the early church had this whole, you know, gathering mentality. First they gathered in Kirtland, then in Independence, then finally Nauvoo before they went out to Salt Lake. And, you know, so you had this kind of immense blend of views and everything that came in. And obviously, then with the addition of the institution of plural marriage, the Latter-day Saints were very much apart from the rest of the American population, which is why, you know, why they were so hated, and, you know, why they had to go out to Utah, where, you know, they were 2,000 miles away in any direction from people who basically hated them. And I think that the church always, you know, resented culturally the fact that they were treated so poorly. And then I think that what happened is that around the 1950s, you had this post-war economic boom where everybody was having babies, everything was great, you know, two cars in every garage, a chicken in every pot, you know, it was this decade of just prosperity and everything for most people. Obviously, there was dark parts to it, you know, the whole civil rights thing and what was going on with that, but you know, but for the most part, it was a decade that was good. And Mormons, for the first time, kind of like burst onto the American mainstream. Like, hey, we're good, wholesome American people just like you. And they started to get a little bit of acceptance in that, you know, and Mormons became, oh, they're these nice people and they're, you know, we don't necessarily agree with them, but like they, you know, they have this great choir and they have, you know, this great, you know, and Salt Lake City is beautiful and all, you know, and so basically they started getting accepted like as this, you know, as an American mainstream. And I think that, you know, as they, you know, as they finally started to get more and more popular and larger, that as this post-Christian society is turning, they're seeing themselves again being looked at as this, these strange outsiders with strange beliefs. And I think they don't know how to handle that in some ways, because in today's woke world, you know, the Latter-day Saint Church, the Latter-day Saint religion is the only one that you can still attack with impunity and nobody cares. I mean, look at how many negative shows have come out on Hulu and Netflix, and I think there's been like 5 or 6 negative shows about the, you know, mainstream negative shows about Mormonism. Some of them are better than others, but, you know, most of them are filled with just nonsense. I mean, I didn't watch any of the Under the Banner of Heaven thing that everybody was talking about, but I read enough synopses of it to know how it's just basically ridiculous nonsense for the most part. And, I think that, though, in a post-Christian world, Latter-day Saints are, again, we're going to be seen as this alien, you know, weird group. And I think that culturally, most members of the church had just gotten used to us being viewed as mainstream Americans. And so now they're like, oh, my goodness, what do I have to do to get people to know I'm just like them? And so they have this kind of post, you're like, oh, I want everybody to view me as this normal person because, you know, we just finally are viewed that way. And now, you know, now it's going to go elsewhere. But I think you're right that that's a mistake. I think that that's just a cultural mistake that stems from, like I said, you know, that just culture moves slow and culture reacts slow to. And the fact of the matter is that the wokists and the secular humanists who have taken over society, they've come like, you know, blisteringly fast. It's all happened very, very quickly.
Well, what's
the church is ready for that?
Well, that's true. But what's interesting is that most of your other faiths, and I can't say most, maybe that's not the right word. It's too absolute of a word. But a lot of your other faiths, and it's probably more Protestant than anything else, have adopted some of the woke, you know, traditions and ideologies, where Mormonism is one of the last strongholds that is not going to adopt that kind of stuff so quickly.
Right. And, you know, and obviously, you know, there's even within the church, there's, you know, the people that, you know, some call the Progmos, who, you know, which stands for Progressive Mormons. Who,
right. And so it's much more heat. It's a much more heated battle out there. And you, right. Sorry, we're talking over each other here.
Oh, well, no, I was just saying, you know, these people, you know, they exist within the church. You know, I don't think that too many of them are in the leadership, although, you know, sometimes I'm not so sure with some of the things that have come out, you know, recently. But But yeah, I mean, it is. It's going to be because of the fact that, you know, there's only so far that they're going to be able to go. And that's, you know, theologically, you know, evangelical churches, you know, that base their church, you know, their theology, you know, purely on the Bible. You know, they can just interpret the Bible in different ways. But, you know, we have, you know, we have, you know, in addition to the Bible, we have the Book of Mormon, we have the Doctrine and Covenants, we have church traditions, statements of past leaders, which, you know, obviously, you know, we're not going to stand on every statement of past leaders because that's not how doctrine in our church works. But at the same time, there's an awful lot more to overcome if they want to sit there and change these things to be more in line with the woke. So I don't see that happening, at least, you know, my belief that it's not going to happen. But, you know, the Catholics are kind of holding strong on that in as a church, not necessarily as a people, because a lot of Catholics don't actually really care what their church says. But you know, the Orthodox, same thing. They're kind of standing strong on that. But you're right, the evangelical Christians, I think that in their case, they got enamored with political power when they were kind of in the ascendancy during the Reagan years. They had the Reagan and Bush years where they were kind of like the big dogs on the block. You know, what the evangelicals had to say was very, 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 very politically relevant. I think that what they've found is that almost overnight, they've lost all political power. Mm-hmm. And because they've lost all political power, they're trying to do whatever they can to gain it. And right now it looks like wokeism is the way to go if you want political power.
So now this is where I'm kind of talking about, you know, where we went wrong. And what I'm hearing these influencers talk about is that, you know, it all went wrong under classical liberalism from the Enlightenment. Now, ironically, around the same time, now these things don't always line up exactly, you know, give 50 years here or there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, here I am thinking that, you know, the United States was just born in 1776. Most of these founders were deists, so they weren't really religious, but they were trying to tie in a religious culture to their Greek understanding of politics. Mm-hmm. And that's what we got. At the same time, you know, Mormonism comes out within 50 years of the country coming. And here we are, we're battling the, you know, the progressives the most, it seems, among Christianity, except for that Orthodox have this 2000 year, you know, unbroken line. So that's where I've been thinking lately.
But if you look at the Orthodox line, they have an unbroken line of tyrants.
Repeat that one more time.
I said, if you look at their line, though, they have an unbroken line of tyrants. I mean, you can't look to the East as a political, you know, panoply. You know, okay, yeah, we're going. You know, say the West has these woke problems, but I mean, you know, the East had the emperor and, you know, the empire, the Byzantine Empire, and, you know, armies, and let's march out and kill everybody, and, you know, then the Russians today, you know, the patriarch of the Russian Eastern Orthodox Church. I mean, I don't want to get into the whole political thing, but with, you know, Russia and Ukraine, I certainly am not going to be waving a Ukrainian flag or, you know, sitting there saying, oh, Ukraine was this, you know, free place. They're totally, totally corrupt. But at the same time, we know that just going in and just conquering or trying to conquer, invading a country is not exactly a Christian thing to do. But the patriarch of that church, the Russian Orthodox Church, is fully on board with Putin's invasion. So I mean, I don't really view that as, you know, that's where we want to politically go. I see why the religion itself is appealing in the fact that, you know, they don't have, you know, these woke people for the most part in their religion. But it's not the Enlightenment that was the problem. I mean, before then, there was the tyranny of kings and emperors. You know, the problem is the idea of government itself. You know, Christians, I think the very earliest Christians understood this. I think that the very earliest Christians were inherently anti-state. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you look at, you know, our claim, the great apostasy, and people like to ask, well, when did this great apostasy happen? And I say, well, it wasn't like this day that you can say, okay, well, this is the date of the great apostasy. It was more like a process. But I think that once the church was fully in bed with the state, which happened around the time of Constantine, you know, once the church was fully in bed with the state, that was it. That was the nail in the coffin. And, you know, obviously the Roman Empire collapsed. So, you know, the church became much more decentralized and much more independent at that point from the state. In fact, I would say that the church in the West was more powerful than the state in many places. But in the East, where the Orthodox held sway, you know, the emperors continued to control the church until the fall of Constantinople in like 1500 something. Let me look that up. I should know that offhand, the date of the sacking of Constantinople.
So, I mean, while you're looking it up, while you're we're talking about the difference between tyrannical oppressive empires in the East, and then of course Enlightenment thinking that led to wokeism in the West. Obviously,
I'm not sure that it's Enlightenment thinking that necessarily led to it. I think that it was okay. So I can understand like where some of the people are going away from libertarian and thinking that it was the Enlightenment. I think that individualism taken to an extreme leads to wokeism.
Okay, well, I agree with that, because then now you have an inversion. That's another word I'm hearing, online is we're living in the inversion, and people are now talking about the self and satisfying the self as an individual rather than looking toward God and, you know, being
right
in unison with heaven's angels.
It was 1453, by the way.
Okay.
So I mean, almost a thousand years after the Roman Empire had fell and the Western Church had gained, you know, more independence from the Roman Empire, the Empire still controlled the Eastern Church.
Okay.
So, I mean, they were tied in with the state for a long time. So I think that in the West, it's not the Enlightenment that was the problem. It was really the culmination of the 30 Years' War. Okay. Because, see, I think that what the danger here, okay, is that these people want to go back to like a theocracy. Mm-hmm. Well, here's the problem. I can understand you wanting a theocracy. I mean, Mormonism, we say the same thing, okay? But what we want is the kingdom of God, okay? We want Jesus Christ to rule, okay? But here's the problem with like staying involved in politics or bringing this to a political level, you know, and is that Jesus Christ, you know, well, you know, I'll irritate about a lot of other Christians when I say this. Jesus Christ isn't here. Okay. He's here like in his spirit, you know, his spirit is here, but he's not physically here on this earth right now, you know, ruling as king. Mm-hmm. And so until he's doing that, if you're going to say, well, we're going to set our church up in charge. Well, guess what? Okay. We have a lot of experience with what that looks like. And we're Latter-day Saints. Do you think that in a theocracy that we're going to have any ability to worship according to the dictates of our conscience, our religion, or are they going to look at us and say, those are heretics and we're going to destroy them? And a lot of people got killed by the church when the church had political sway. You know, a lot of people got killed because they had heterodox views of doctrines, and that's the danger with theocracy. You know, that's I know you saw the movie and you made a comment about it, so I'm not sure if you've read it. Have you read the Dune series?
I haven't read it. I did see the movie. It's just not my thing, but you know, I know a lot of people are into it.
Well, it's very, very good, especially if you want to get into the dangers of theocracy. Okay, because you know, Paul, you've seen the movie, so spoiler alert for anybody who's seen the movie, Paul becomes a horrible tyrant. Mm. Okay, because you know, basically the Fremen look at him. You know, the Fremen are this oppressed group. And, but, you know, in reality, the most important thing in the Dune universe is the spice.
Right.
And since the Fremen have real power on Arrakis, and Arrakis is the only place to get the spice, that means that properly leveraged, the Fremen are the most powerful group in the universe. And because they control the spice. So, you know, they're this oppressed group, and they kind of get their messiah in Paul. And, you know, And Paul, you know, later on through the spice and everything, he gains basically like godlike powers almost. Like he can tell the future. He can see, you know, exactly what's going to happen. But because of his power and everything, he becomes the salvation, if you will, the savior, the messiah of the Fremen. But that unleashes this Fremen upon the entire universe. And, you know, he just becomes this horrible tyrant. You know, I think in Dune Messiah, he's talking about his jihad, if you will, the jihad that kind of chose him as their leader. He talks about, he mentions, like, there was way back in our history, there was this guy named Hitler, and he killed like 6 million people. And he was like, you know, and everybody thought that was pretty good. You know, by conservative estimate, my jihad has killed like 13 or 20 times that many people or something. You know, multiple billions of people. And then, of course, his son, you know, in Children of Dune, and then the God Emperor of Dune becomes the God Emperor and, you know, rules for, you know, 4,000 years and becomes kind of like a half worm creature. Kills hundreds of billions of people. Okay. All in the name of the fact that this, you know, they're enforcing this new religion. And I think that that's, you know, so I don't think that it's the Enlightenment's the problem. I think that what happened was that, you know, you look at the 30 Years' War, okay? This was a war that was primarily fought in Europe between basically Catholics and Protestants. And at the result, and at the end of that, they came up with what was called the Treaty of Westphalia, okay? And the Treaty of Westphalia basically, you know, said that that's basically where the idea of the modern nation state came from. Okay. Because up until then, it was like kingdoms. Like, I'm the king of this people and I'm the king of this people and we're going to fight with each other. And they didn't really have like solid geographical lines. Okay. But at Westphalia, which was the culmination of the 30 Years' War, they came up with this idea of nation states and national sovereignty. And I think that's really where we have the issues that we're facing today on a political level. On a cultural level, it was, you know, too much individualism, which is not really, that's not really a political ideal. It's more of a philosophical and religious ideal. So sure. I don't know if any of that, I don't know if that in the, any of my incoherent rambling that helped you or not?
Well, you know, so if I think definitely the thing you said at the end there, that, you know, politics is like a new religion in the world right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty bad at naming internet personalities myself sometimes, but it was somebody I listened to who said that, you know, what we're seeing with people is that they're having a God-shaped hole in their heart. And so they're trying to fit. We talked about nihilism at the beginning, right? And this is what Jordan Peterson, you know, a lot of his career is based on trying to battle this nihilistic culture that we have right now.
Well, I mean, this gets into the whole, you know, Nietzsche and what he said, and you know, a lot of the you know, your secularists will quote Nietzsche and say God is dead. Well, I don't think they understand what Nietzsche was talking about. You know, he wasn't saying like, yay, God is dead. He was saying like, oh no, God is dead. Like, nobody's following him. Everybody's following the secular human view. And we better come up with this, you know, this way of having values. Because here's the thing, you know, I've had a lot of atheists who tell me, oh, you don't need to be religious to be moral. You don't need to be, you know, you don't need to have, you know, morality doesn't need to have a religious background or whatever. But my question is, you know, it kind of does if you think about it, because if there's no God and this is all here by random chance, okay, this is just a chaotic universe with all kinds of swirling forces that we don't understand and there's no eternal nothing and every, you know, then we are just a speck of dust on a speck of dust on a speck of dust when you think of the grand size of the universe, which means that whenever anybody ever thinks about that, then that in the absence of God, life is ultimately meaningless. Mm-hmm. Because what does it matter? We're already dead, basically. You know, this is when you get into time prescience, you know, in the grand scheme of things, we're dead, and nothing that we do and nothing that we say and nothing we accomplish matters, because it's all just going to be dust and blown away in the end.
Well, not only that, are we dead and nothing else, nothing has meaning, nothing else matters, is that on top of that, in conjunction with that, if nothing has meaning, then what difference does it make if we have a choice? Right.
True.
And so a lot of you anarchists, types of atheists will say, you know, we have free will. It's like, well, how do you have free will if nothing has meaning? You have a will to do what? You're just kind of programmed by the elements of the world. And right. you're not even like controlling your thoughts. You're just kind of, you know, going where, whatever.
Right. That's the other thing. If there's no soul, if there's no spirit in man, then our thoughts are just chemical processes. They're just chemical processes that are happening randomly because of chemistry and biology, and they don't actually have, there's no, we're not even really anything. We're just a walking bundle of chemical processes.
Well, so, and that's why this wokeism is so weird or so dangerous, probably, because in game theory, or a lot of gamers will call these people NPCs, right?
Right.
You know, they don't have any ideology except for just follow whatever the latest thing is, right? You know,
right.
I'm gonna follow whatever the latest thing is. I have no ideology. I'm just, I'm soulless. I'm mindless. I'm a zombie, pretty much, because they don't have any meaning. So, I mean, you're probably right. Like I said, I was just entertaining some thoughts about, the Enlightenment. You got all these post-libertarians now. You got,
I just don't think that they're right that the Enlightenment was the problem. I mean, the Enlightenment was, let's use our minds, Yes. Okay. They have a point in the medieval world before the Enlightenment, people were more in touch with the mystical reality. Okay. Because of the fact that, there was so much in the world that we didn't understand, that we couldn't, understand, because we didn't have the technology to understand it, because we didn't have the knowledge to understand it. The Enlightenment was just the gaining of knowledge, the gaining of scientific knowledge. I don't think that, I think that it's unfortunate, and I don't know how, I mean, I have my ideas on how to counter it, but I think it's unfortunate that people think that science somehow disproves the mystical world, mm-hmm. because to my way of thinking, it does not. And maybe that's a result of me being a Latter-day Saint, because we have a very materialistic cosmology. Okay. For instance, like you said, Mormonism is mystical. There's a lot of mystical aspects to it. But we also don't deny science, being that our cosmology is materialistic. We believe in a material God, a God that has a physical body that resides in a physical place somewhere in the universe, in right. time, in space.
Which that so what you're saying there is kind of where I was talking about earlier, is that the idea that God has a body, that's not, I mean, besides Christ, right? From what I hear, a lot of the Eastern Orthodox will call God like an essence or pure logos, or some kind of bodiless form.
Similar to the Catholics, then, where he's like more of a force, like he's not like a being, he's a force.
Right. Which I actually kind of like that principle, except for the fact that I do believe that God has a body, because if God does not have a body, then how can anyone tell you what you can and can't do with your body or with your gender or any of that kind of stuff?
Here's the thing, it's interesting, because a lot of Christians will get to us on the fact that we're not Trinitarians, okay? Or at least we're not Trinitarians in the way that they understand the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
But, we believe in the three, the kind of the grand divine council, the Heavenly Father, God the Son, God the Holy Ghost. Well, guess what? God the Father having a body, Jesus Christ having a body, Holy Ghost, we say, doesn't have a body. Well, guess what? There's your essence. There's your force that can go throughout the universe.
Right.
So there is a reason that, there is that third element to the Godhead that, so I think that denying God has a body, it doesn't open up, for there to be more essence, more spiritual essence, because God doesn't have a body. I think that this is a result of Neoplatonism Platonism. This came into the church way before the Orthodox were even around, because the split, you know, between Catholicism and Eastern Orthodox, that happened in 1054.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I think that the idea of an unembodied God, that was more of an essence, this was a pagan idea. This was what came from Neoplatonism, which kind of started infecting the church, you know, by around the 3rd century.
Well, isn't there a creed called the Athanasian Creed that has something about, you know, the bodiless God written in it?
I've read the Athanasian Creed. I don't remember it off the top of my head. Obviously, being a Latter-day Saint, we do not, we do not hold to any of these creeds. So I haven't memorized them all. You're probably right. There's a couple of them. Last time I read the Athanasian Creed, I didn't see a whole lot in there that I objected to. But I think that my understanding of it would probably be different than the people who hold to that creed.
Yeah, yeah. Something that you said earlier is that outsiders, I guess, from our inner circle of Mormonism will look at us like we're the crazy ones, right?
Well, right, so, because they don't, I mean, well, here's the thing. I mean, you and I, you know, we hang around a lot of other Mormons, okay? We hang around them in groups on the internet. We hang around them in real life. We know that they're just regular people for the most part, you know, going about their daily lives and whatever. But, you know, there's 1 billion Catholics in the world. There's lots and lots of Orthodox. And there's, you know, I think the last that the church counted was like 17 million members of, you know, Latter-day Saints.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that if you take into account those who don't actually go to church, you know, it's probably more like 9 million. But I mean, the other ones may still believe in it; they just don't necessarily attend. But even if you take the 17 million number, though, that is a tiny, tiny fraction, because that's 17 million spread throughout the world. Okay, and then in the United States, obviously Utah is majority Latter-day Saints still, but there's no other state in the country that has a majority of Latter-day Saints. I think California, where I am, is the second highest by percentage, and I think it's only like maybe 5% out here. So it's pretty small. Tonga is the only other country I can think of that this majority Latter-day Saint is Tonga. But there's only like 200,000 people that live in Tonga or something like that. I mean, it's not a huge population. But I think the last I said that they're like 52% Latter-day Saint or something. So, but for the most part, most people don't know anything about Mormons. They really don't. What they know is they know it from, you know, the Book of Mormon musical, or they know it from Under the Banner of Heaven, or, you know, any number of these other stupid shows that are out there that unfortunately just, you know, offer a distorted version of reality. So they don't know. They don't know anything. So they're going to look at us like we're weirdos. I mean, half of the time that I spend when I get into theological debates with people online, half the time I spend is just saying, no, that's not what we believe. And I don't know why you think that's what we believe. I can't even get into what we do believe because I'm spending most of my time telling them that what they think we believe is not correct.
Yeah, there's a negative presupposition, I guess, if you would call it that. So they're trying to say who we are, and we're trying to say that's not us, and we're talking past each other because we're not listening to this is what we believe actually. You know, maybe we have more in common than what you think we do.
Well, you know, I had an epiphany the other day because I was thinking about this a lot. Okay, because if you look at, you know, our fiercest critics are usually Calvinists. I have started to notice that very recently. Our fiercest critics are usually Calvinists. And I started to think about why that is. And then I noticed something. Every time that there's like a Mormonism versus Christianity group or something, and I go on there and there's a Calvinist debating a Latter-day Saint, this whole Calvinist says something along the lines of, you believe that you're saved by works. And then a Latter-day Saint will say, no, we don't believe we're saved by works, but you certainly have to go do these good works and everything. And then the Calvinists, they're talking about something totally different, because you'll see the Latter-day Saints start sitting there defending the necessity of doing good work, mm-hmm. like going out and helping people. They're like, well, Jesus said you should do this, and Jesus said you should do this. And the Calvinist is like sitting there saying, well, you believe you're saved by works. I've tried to figure this out. I finally had an epiphany. It's not that they believe that we're, you know, when we're sitting there defending our good works, you know, going out and helping people and stuff, that's not what they're accusing us of thinking we're saved by. They're literally saying that our belief that baptism is essential means that we're saved by works. Their belief that we believe that you actually have to have ordinances performed in order to be saved, to them means we believe we're saved by works. That's why they have the exact same criticism of the Catholics. That's why they have the exact same criticism of the Orthodox.
Because they don't believe in ordinances are important.
They don't believe that the ordinances are necessary for salvation. So when they say we believe that we're saved by works, and a Latter-day Saint starts defending the necessity for good works, we're talking past them. What we have to tell them is why the ordinances are necessary, because that's what they're actually saying. I just realized that recently after arguing with these people for almost 20 years now. So
yeah. So, you know, like I said, growing up Lutheran, I remember we had, and I can say this for a typical Mormon, because it's I don't want to get too deep here, but I kind of want to. Within the Mormon religious service practice, regular Sunday worship is very plain, very vanilla, very Protestant-like, right? It's there's not a lot of liturgy going on inside the regular church, with the exception of the sacrament.
Right.
Most of our liturgy is in a temple, right? And so a lot of people like Orthodoxy because the liturgy has deep meaning to them, but the Protestants don't really have deep liturgy either, so they're missing a lot of that stuff.
Right. If you've gone to the temple enough times and you go to a Catholic mass, I kind of look at Catholic Mass as like they've taken the sacrament meeting and the temple liturgy and kind of put them together, only they've lost parts out of it.
Okay.
Okay. So I think that that's where that comes from. I think because, you know, again, we're going on the supposition that we hold that we are a restoration of the ancient church, meaning that the ancient church had the same beliefs and practices that we do. And I think that when you look at the Mass and where that comes from, and Orthodox liturgy is very similar to Catholic Mass. You know, they're very similar in many, liturgically, they're very similar. You know, the filioque is something they argued about. I wish I was up on all that right now. It's like a wording, like basically where the sun came from and all this other stuff. But liturgically, the services are very similar, and they do have these deep meaning liturgical meaning in there. And unfortunately, we, as Latter-day Saints, a lot of that is missing from our Sunday worship. And I think that is because of where we came from when we got started. I often wonder what would happen if the Restoration, if the New Yorkers that surrounded Joseph Smith, instead of being Methodists and Baptists and Presbyterians, would have been Catholics and Orthodox. You know, I think that would have been an interesting thing to see if there was more of those people who came into the very early church. That being said, I don't necessarily think that our meetings would be that much different, because I kind of see the Mass as like they kind of took elements of the temple ceremony and then the sacrament and kind of mashed them together and then do them all out front instead of separating the two.
Yeah. So one thing that I don't really like about Mormon culture is that, you know, people don't understand the sacred nature of like some of the things we do in a temple, the ordinances and the rituals, the liturgy in the temple is sacred. But, you know, it's not profane to talk about those things, to educate regular people about some of that stuff.
I think that this comes from, you know, it comes from the fact that, you know, the temple ceremony itself talks about, you know, don't go and broadcast this out for the world. I think what people are missing, though, is that it's not the liturgy itself that we're prohibited from talking about. Like, you know, you go in and, you know, people ask, well, what do you do in the temple? Well, when you first go through it, you get washings and anointings, which is very similar you really want to understand what it's like, read Exodus, where Moses was anointing Aaron. Okay. Washington anointing is very similar to what happened in Exodus when Moses was anointing Aaron. Then you see, you know, a divine, a play, if you will. I don't know if it's a better word, but it's, you know, it's a story.
It's a dramatization,
right? It's a dramatization where basically it's basically where the worshiper takes upon themselves. If they're a man, you're supposed to be like you're Adam, and if you're a woman, you're supposed to be like you're Eve, and then they do a dramatization of the Adam and Eve story. You know, obviously adding some things in there, and then they add some, you know, the signs and tokens, if you will. And the signs and tokens, that's what we're actually not supposed to talk about. We're not supposed to show somebody, oh, well, this is the sign and this is what it's called and this is what it means. We're not, so those are sacred. But we can explain people, you know, the liturgy itself is the dramatization of the Adam and Eve story, in which the worshipers are taking upon themselves in that role and then working through a step-by-step progression, the liturgy, if you will, to go from Adam in a fallen world to exaltation or communion with the divine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what the temple liturgy is.
Right, right. I'm just looking at the time right now here in Illinois. It's after midnight. So I think that I probably want to schedule another conversation with you, Jason, in a shorter time than 2 years. I want to come full circle to where I started, though,
mm-hmm.
because, like I said, there among the influencer world that I'm, you know, kind of tipping my toe in, you know, there's a lot of good things happening as far as, you know, finding Christianity, finding truth, and a lot of people are looking for truth, and still, even among those people, there's still this internal battle about, you know, which truth is correct, right? You know, the Orthodox, right. The Mormons, the Catholics, so they're getting more vocal online, at least in the last couple of years, which I think is a good thing. But you know, the compelling nature and argumentative nature that I am, I always want to interject in. Oh, let me tell you about Mormonism, right? But right. Nobody cares about Mormonism, so that's why I wanted to invite you on and be like.
Well, I mean, if you want people to care about Mormonism, honestly, we're gonna have to get into. You're gonna have to do a deep dive into the unique doctrines that exist within Mormonism that I think makes it truly a beautiful religion. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we have our problems within it. We have cultural, you know, we have a huge nationalism problem within the American church. Mm-hmm. We have way too many Latter-day Saints who seem to equate the federal government with, you know, some kind of divine institution. So we're not without problems in our institution. But when you look at the actual theology that was introduced by Joseph Smith and his successors, it's a beautiful system. It's a beautiful faith system. It's eminently reasonable. And in my opinion, now that I have seen the Bible through Latter-day Saint eyes, if you will, I don't think I could see it in a different way, because to me, it's very clearly, like, it's right in front of me. Yes, that makes sense. Whereas when I was a Lutheran, when I was a Baptist, you know, there was always a lot of things that people would be like, well, I don't necessarily, or I don't necessarily understand what that means. And I'll look at things and say, I don't necessarily understand what that means either, but they're bigger questions that nobody can answer because we've not been there yet. So they have always had an answer in my way.
And I agree with you. So let me just wrap with this thought. Do you think that people who, I'm trying to see how I can say this. So I heard somebody put an idea out there that kind of where I'm going. When somebody leaves the church, if they're apostates, for example, mm-hmm. they don't really, they have this higher understanding, like what you're talking about, like this different mm-hmm. perspective. They don't necessarily will go to a less informed perspective like Protestants when they leave the church.
It's very uncommon.
They become atheists, right? So if they don't see Mormonism as being true, then they won't become like a Lutheran again or Baptist. They'll become more of an atheist than anything else.
Right. And, you know, and I can understand it. It makes sense to me, actually, because once you understand the theological truths that Mormonism provides and how it fills in the missing picture so that you have a much fuller picture of the divine. If something were to happen to shake your faith in that, I don't think you would go back to a lesser, again, kind of like, think of it almost like when you play one of those games where they have like a picture on a TV screen and it starts off all blurry and fuzzy and everything, and maybe even moving around a bit, and then it starts to become clearer and settles and stabilizes, and you see, oh yeah, that's a dog, or that's a house, or, you know, whatever it is, you see the picture a lot more clearly. I think that that's kind of like going from one of those other faiths into Mormonism. Like, you had kind of a blurry picture before, now you're going to a more clear picture. And so then if something happens that shakes your faith in that, I want to go back to my blurry picture. It's, I think this picture is stupid and I'm going to throw it aside. And unfortunately, when that happens, then these people become very much, very much, you know, very much targets for this ideological wokeism that's out there in the world, because it provides some meaning for them. Now, that's the thing that we kind of got into, like the nihilism and, like, you know, what the lack of religion does in a life. You know, one thing I can say is I'll always be allies with, you know, these people who believe differently than me, as far as, you know, Catholics, Orthodox, not so much the Calvinists, but I mean, I'm allies with them. I just think their God is a monster. But, you know, but in any case, you know, the point is, you know, I at least they have a guiding value in their life. Okay. That's not going to be destructive. At the very least, you know, Orthodox have made beautiful things. Catholics have made beautiful things. Evangelicals have made beautiful things, even if they're annoying. But nihilists, they don't know where to go. And if they can't find peace in a religion, then they find peace in this wokeism, because it provides something. Because nobody wants, you know, true nihilists are actually pretty rare. We talked about nihilism being on the rise, but the reason that wokeism is on the rise is because that provides an escape from nihilism.
Right, that fills a God-shaped hole in people's hearts.
Right, exactly. You mentioned the God-shaped hole. It builds a goal toward which they can function, which in their case is the perfect, you know, utopian, you know, woke utopian state where everybody holds hands and sings Kumbaya all day long or something. I don't know what their woke world actually looks like, because it's unachievable. But all utopias are unachievable. That's what the word utopia means. When Thomas More first coined the term, when he wrote the book, it literally means the place that is no place.
Mm.
That's literally what the word utopia means. So, but, you know, basically, yeah. So that's why we have the problem with the progmos, if you will, in the church, is that when people start to lose faith in the church, they're not going to go to a less informed or less clear picture. They're going to go to, you know, nihilism, and then that's going to be short-lived, and they're going to find wokeism as an alluring thing, and then they come back and they start criticizing the church for being anti-woke. So
yeah,
that's the one danger I would say. But that's not, you know, that's unfortunately, you know, it's kind of the truth, you know. Like you know, we talked about you know, apostates and everything, and there's an old teaching in the church. Now, I don't necessarily think that somebody that leaves the church is going to go to outer darkness or something like that. But, you know, there was that teaching for a long time that, you know, apostates went to outer darkness. I think at a psychological level, that's true, because of the fact that, you know, I can't think of a person who buys into this woke stuff that's truly a happy person.
Mm.
I think they all have an anger, a resentment, a bitterness, you know, whether it's toward, you know, a former church, whether it's toward a rival ideology, whether it's toward life or being itself. Jordan Peterson talks a lot about that. You mentioned him several times. He talks about, you know, it being a rejection of being itself. So I don't think you find too many people that are, you know, of that mindset who are happy. And obviously, you know, that's a state of darkness. So you leave the truth, you go to darkness. And that, yeah, so that's true.
So, well, it'll be interesting how this plays out because, you know, I don't think wokeism is going to basically eat itself. And people are going to eventually say, I don't want anything to do with this.
Well, I think they might. I think they might be reaching a tipping point with this whole. I actually think maybe sports might be what ends up waking the world up when, you know, when people are demanding that men be able to play in all the women's sports. I think that I think people are not going to be able to, you know, when they start allowing the men into the women's sports who are calling themselves women and they start winning every single time. Well, eventually somebody's going to say, look, this is nonsense. We got to stop.
Yes, so exactly.
That's my hope, but at the same time, you know, I unfortunately, you know, it talks in the Book of Mormon and in the Bible about, you know, the latter days and that the whole world will be in commotion, and you know, it pretty much predicts this stuff, and you know, it doesn't get better for a while. It gets bad before it gets better.
So we end up where we started in the conversation. We are in apocalypse. The apocalypse just means, enlightenment could be kind of a word for apocalypse, right? It means the awakening.
It means revelation. That's why, you know, in some Bibles, the book of Revelation is the apocalypse of John.
Right.
You know, because apocalypse is just a Greek word meaning revelation. And everybody, obviously, because of what the book of Revelation deals with, you know, it's come to mean this like end of days scenario thing. You know, you have the zombie apocalypse or you know, whatever. You know, I'm less worried. You know, my children sometimes ask me, you know, well, what would you do if the zombie apocalypse happened? And what about this situation, the zombie apocalypse? I tell them all the time. I say, you know, I'd worry less about the zombie apocalypse that might come, and worry a lot more about the idiot apocalypse that's already upon us.
Well, there you go. There you go. All right, my brother, I appreciate the conversation. We're going to do this again because I want to get more into it. Barring that you have the time to do it now that you're a busy man and, you know, preparing for school to start, you know, in a couple of weeks or next week, right?
I have to go back Tuesday. I have to go back Tuesday, but I don't have any students coming back until the 17th.
Okay.
So I get about a week. I have to go in about a week before the students come there just so I can, you know, start preparing lesson plans and stuff.
All right. Well, let me close the podcast with this. I know that you're a guy who's not really wanting to be known publicly, so you probably don't have any plugs or anything, right?
No, I don't. I'm just trying to live my quiet life, teaching where I can and watching baseball.
All right. Well, very cool. Very cool. I will plug the Invictus Mind podcast. If you're listening to it, you already know where you find it. It is also on YouTube if you hear the audio version only and vice versa. We are actually promoting this week the Financial Revolution webinar, which is free to join. You can just go to therevolutionstartswithyou.co. And if you caught my last episode with the Financial Ninja, my friend Frank kind of explained what we're teaching that for people. So I appreciate your time, brother. And, you know, obviously we'll continue talking. So love you, man.
Absolutely. You too.